John Steenhuisen is the leader of the Democratic Alliance, member of the Government of National Unity and the Minister of Agriculture, which I guess puts you in a very difficult spot right now, John. But you can talk us through this. It's as far as voters, your constituency are concerned, many of whom are members of the BizNews tribe. They are shaking their heads at what's going on politically between South Africa and the United States. How are you reading what Donald Trump, aided and abetted by the South African-born and raised Elon Musk, is actually saying right now?
Well, obviously, it's very concerning, Alec. And, you know, there are grave implications for South Africa if the United States indeed goes through with tariffs and continues to cut aid. It's not as simple as Gwilym and Tasha tried to make it out yesterday. There are huge implications in the agri sector particularly. And so what you have to do in situations like this is always balance your political needs along with the needs of the country. We're talking about thousands upon thousands of jobs here. And ironically, the people who would probably be affected most by this particular input of tariffs on South African goods would probably be large commercial farmers in the South African space who have found a good market in the United States for their products. And so we have to get through this impasse, and we have to get through it in a way that ensures that South Africa's national interests are also protected. And so when we discuss these things, we must do so based on facts, and we must do so in a rational way, without getting hysterical, and make sure that we navigate what I think are going to be a choppy 5 years for South Africa in relation with the United States. Certainly, if we see what President Trump has done in Canada and Mexico and other places, I think that we do need to gird ourselves for what's going to be, I think, a very bumpy ride for the next 5 years.
Well, breaking news this morning is that both Canada and Mexico have capitulated, and it appears as though Trump is no longer going to apply those 25% tariffs. The Canadians are saying they will strengthen their border. The Mexicans are going to put 10,000 troops onto ensuring that the drugs and illegal immigrants don't go into America. So perhaps it was all just a negotiating issue. Is there a chance that this is the situation in South Africa as well? In other words, Trump is the transactional president in America, is now wanting to negotiate who knows what, but certainly that could be his approach.
Well, I certainly hope so, because that means that we will be in a position to be able to negotiate. And that's really where the sweet spot sits here. I think that the sooner the South African government and potentially the president, but certainly a delegation, gets to the United States to have discussions with the president and to appraise him of what's going on in South Africa, to indicate what the priorities of government are through the medium-term development plan and the focus on growth and jobs. And also, I think, to make sure, and this is a responsibility that falls to me, to make sure that we're also giving the United States a fair deal in terms of their requested access to the South African market on things like poultry and pork hearts and livers. Which have been a source of some contention over the last 2 years. I've also taken the unprecedented step of sending an agricultural attaché to Washington, the first time we'd have an agricultural attaché in Washington in the last 9 years. And Dr. Jafta's prime focus is going to be on dealing with some of the phytosanitary concerns and easing the relationship that we have in terms of biosecurity and phytosanitary and also being a good steward for South Africa's agricultural products there. But we are going to, it's definitely not business as usual. But as I say, if it's about negotiation, well, I think we can definitely play in that space. But we're going to have to box clever. And comments that, well, we'll just cut off minerals to the United States of America is not the way to go. We need to de-escalate this, not to escalate it, because the last thing we can afford to do is to lose one of the largest trading partners that we have and one of the largest investors in our economy.
That's a very good point. There was a statement from Cyril Ramaphosa's office this morning which suggested that, well, yes, America provide 17% of the HIV/AIDS budget for South Africa. So yes, we're going to be sad to lose that, but that's all that they provide. However, I ask you to just consider a few companies: Ford, IBM, McDonald's, KFC, Macro, Game, Hi-Fi Corporation, Amazon, General Electric, Pepsi-Cola, Dell, Visa and MasterCard, Johnson & Johnson, Kellogg's. The list goes on and on. And if you were to allow this, you as politicians, you as the government of national unity, to deteriorate into a full-on trade war, who knows what the implications might be for the hundreds of thousands of people who are employed by those companies.
Absolutely. And so this goes beyond just the aid. I mean, the aid is one thing, and we must park that to one side. And let me just remind you, Alec, that if it wasn't for PEPFAR, millions of our fellow countrymen and women would have been condemned to death, particularly in the early 90s. And it was the PEPFAR program. And I come from KwaZulu-Natal, which is the province, as you know, that had the highest burden of HIV/AIDS. And literally, PEPFAR has saved hundreds of thousands of lives of ordinary South Africans through providing antiretroviral treatment and the like. But secondly, there is the trade element, and America remains one of our largest trading partners and one of the largest FDI contributors in South Africa.
FDI?
And so they can't just foreign direct investment. They cannot just simply be waved away with the hand and said, well, you know, we'll find somebody else to talk to. They are huge investors in the South African economy and are very important to us. Somebody joked to me yesterday, but I mean, I think there's some truth to it, that Cyril Ramaphosa, the president, should phone Donald Trump and invite him, book off Leopard Creek and get Johann Rupert, Ernie Els, and Gary Player together and get a four ball of golf so they could actually, you know, talk about what the real situation is in South Africa and so that he is appraised with exactly what is going on here.
It does behove me to ask you these questions, which are being asked by your constituents. What will it take for the Democratic Alliance to withdraw from the government of national unity? What will it, what kind of a, because when you're sitting outside of the parliament, when what you see from the outside is fire and brimstone being visited upon South Africa by a country whose GDP is more than 70 times bigger than ours. And we're standing there like a guy walks into the lion's ring and pulls the whiskers of the lion without the protection of any cage. That seems to be what we're doing at the moment. So the only hope, I guess, for some people is get the DA out of the government of national unity, have a vote of no confidence in the president. He will fall, the government will fall, a new government, or that supply and confidence arrangement that Helen Ziller was supposedly proposing would come into play, and sanity would prevail, perhaps. But where are you positioned on this, and how are you seeing it?
Well, I did a press conference last week, and I made it very clear. We will leave the government of national unity where we are prevented from being part of the growth and jobs agenda. We entered government to grow the economy, to create jobs, and to fight poverty in South Africa. The moment we're prevented from doing that, we will have to leave. I've said out very clearly, for instance, if government proceeds with the aspects of the NHI that involve the collapse of the private healthcare sector and collapsing all medical aids into a single fund, that would have a huge bunker-busting blowout on the balance sheets of South Africa and our budget and our economy. It would be impossible to stay if that proceeded to those parts of the NHI that we regard as pernicious. But also, if we any instance where the Constitution is trashed and the economy crashed, we will have to move. But the thing is, Alec, it's very easy for armchair critics like R.W. Johnson and others to write from the luxury of their Constantia villas, all these things. The reality is simply this. The moment that the DA withdraws from the government of national unity, the president will seek, or those in his party, will seek common ground with the EFF and MK, which will provide them very easily with the parliamentary majority. And then we will see a full-scale tilt towards radical populism and Chavez-style economics. And overnight, we'll see a collapse. So even in then, you enter into some bizarre confidence and supply. Why would they need you in a confidence and supply arrangement if they already have coalition partners that can get them over the top? And so these things, like coalitions, are not easy. They're very difficult, and they're a lot more complex than just simply drawing a line from point A to point B. There's a million different points of energy between them that cloud the situation. And so we believe that whilst we're in the government of national unity, we're going to continue to push the growth and jobs agenda, and every single DA minister into the medium-term development plan put forward plans for their department that focused on growth in the economy, job creation, and combating poverty. We've carried many of those things through into the medium-term development plan. Legislation that will be coming from the new government will all be put through the lens of, is this going to create growth and jobs? Now, there's been a few hangovers from the previous sixth administration, and I know that some people are very exercised about them. But let's take the Bella Bill, for example, Alec. What is the first principle that's being protected by why are people upset about that? And it was that it's threat to mother tongue instruction in South Africa. Now, has the situation been ideal? No, but I think we have been able to hammer out a compromise where a DA minister now, Siviri Gokube, is drafting the regulations that will make sure that it is implemented, because there are large parts of Bella that we agree with. It's those aspects that take away the rights of parents and the choice of school governing bodies that we are upset with. But we can fix those through regulations. So it's not an ideal situation, but it's a lot better given the alternative. Because what is the alternative? If we walked away over Bella, for instance, the EFF would have entered government, and Malema has already signaled that very clearly on social media. Says, when the DA leaves, we are ready into government. And he's tweeted it. He said it in column inches in newspapers. What would the net effect of that been on mother tongue instruction? Well, one of the EFF's first demands is that Afrikaans is removed from the STEM. I guarantee you, under an ANC-EFF/MK alliance, Afrikaans will be under serious assault. Single medium schools will no longer be there. And Afrikaans will probably be removed as an official language. So how have you helped entrench and protect mother tongue instruction by walking out? The reality is, in a coalition, you only get one chance to walk out. And when you walk out, it better be on a matter serious enough that you can explain to your voters and then go back and sit in the opposition benches and with some credibility. Walking out over peripheral matters will be something very hard to explain to voters, particularly when in 3 months' time, the rand has gone through the ceiling and it's gone through the floor, and the economy has started to unravel very quickly, and there's capital flight. Bear in mind as well that even the Western Cape and the Sea of Cape Town, run by the DA, would not be immune to a radical Chavez-style government at a national level. And wealthy people will start to leave, investors will leave, and it will eventually have a knock-on effect on places like the Western Cape and the City of Cape Town. So I'm very clear, Alec, I'm not wedded to the national the GNU at all costs, but I'm wedded there as long as we can create growth and jobs. The moment that becomes impossible, believe you me, we're very happy to walk, but I need to then be able to explain why we've walked in very clear, certain terms to the voters.
So what about the reset that you spoke about at some length? Have you had any feedback from your partners in the GNU on that?
Well, look, as you know, a lot of the partners were very upset about the way in which the expropriation bill was handled and the signing of it, and expressed that. And that certainly has been expressed to the president by almost all his coalition partners. I had a one-on-one lunch with the president last week. I said out very clearly my unhappiness at the way in which that situation was handled. And I made it very clear to him that this is a partnership. This is not a continuation of the ANC 6th administration. There was an election. The voters have decided that the ANC should not have a majority. And therefore, the ANC cannot operate it as if they want a majority. And that if this is to be a genuine partnership, we all need to be involved in the decision-making and that we need to meet more regularly. And that as leaders in the GNU, we need to be engaging more regularly on managing the politics of the coalition, not just the mechanics of government, but the politics of the coalition. And there's been a commitment now to put in place mechanisms to deal with that. And obviously, we'll see how it goes. We've still got to finalize the medium-term development plan. There's always the backstop of the budget. If we're unhappy about what is being done or things that we believe are wrong, we have the budget in which we can negotiate. And if there are things in the budget that remain, like the abolition of private medical care, huge amounts of money wired towards crashing the private healthcare sector in South Africa, well, obviously, we would have to look at that budget very carefully and say, well, do we vote for it or do we vote against it? So there are these safeguards and guardrails that are in place to ensure that we can influence and also get some of what we want. Bearing in mind, we too didn't get 51%. So we too cannot get everything that we want on the table, but we should be able to get some things of what we want on the table.
Talking about the budget, one of the issues that appears to be a flashpoint is the bailing out of Transnet. It, again, could be, as we're seeing with Eskom, it appears, just the beginning of an endless stream of taxpayer money that has to go into it, rather than a more radical approach of privatizing. If there is a bailout in the budget that's going to be presented by Enoch Godendwana on the 19th of February, would you vote against it?
Well, we'd have to see what that money is set aside for. Is it if it's for preparation towards a public-private partnership, as is contained in the medium-term development plan, as is contained in Operation Vulindlela's second stage, we would have to see what that money is being used for. If it's going in to bail out salaries and the like, it would be very difficult for us to necessarily vote for it. If it's money that's being set aside to lay the groundwork for a proper 15, 20, 30-year concessioning of rail routes in South Africa, we would have to look at it. We're getting a presentation on the budget on Wednesday at a cabinet level, and obviously there we would be able to start to look at some of the granular issues there and obviously make an assessment and weigh it up. And again, we're not going to get everything we want in the budget, but certainly we would like to see certain things reflected in the budget that we regard as priorities for the growth and jobs agenda going forward.
You did well. You didn't answer my question. If it's in the budget as a bailout, John, are you going to walk?
If it's in there and it's for salaries and for nonsense, like we've seen over SAA and other things, it was for salaries and not. But if it's there and set aside very clearly to start to prepare Transnet for a public-private partnership, which is definitely the route that's been looked at in both the medium-term development plan as well as Operation Vulindlela. There's a lot of interest, particularly on the infrastructure, the rail infrastructure, but the rail infrastructure seen as part of a holistic logistics issue in South Africa involving the ports as well. If we lay the groundwork for that, I think we'd have a hard time arguing against it. But you know, if it was for salaries and executive pay, absolutely not.
What about the proposed new U.S. ambassador, getting back to the American relationship, Joel Pollack? He's a senior editor at Breitbart, which is probably one of the reddest flags you could wave in front of an ANC bull. He has been widely tipped to come in. He's written this week about what Donald Trump has done with South Africa in cutting off aid. He could make an already inflamed situation even further inflamed. What's your take on his potential appointment, and how would the DA handle that?
Well, it's interesting. When I first met Joel over a decade ago, he was working in Tony Leon's, actually longer than a decade ago, giving my age away here, Alec. He was a speechwriter in Tony Leon's office, but at that stage, he was a very left-leaning Clinton Democrat, and obviously he's had a personal transition in terms of his ideology. Look, we can't choose who the U.S. sends here, just as they can't really choose who we sent there. But what I would immediately seek to do is to have a meeting with the new ambassador, explain to him what we are trying to do with the Government of National Unity, and why it is important that important partners like the US are good allies to the project that we're embarking upon here. Because I think if we can make the Government of National Unity succeed, if we can get economic growth, and we can start to get some political stability here, that can only be good for the region and can only be good for Africa. Whether the US likes it or not, South Africa is a key player on the African continent. And we are a strategic partner from both an economic, but also from a geopolitical point of view. And I think it behoves us to try and ensure that we maintain good relations. So regardless of where he's from and what his writings are, I think Joel has close links with South Africa. And I certainly don't think he wants to see South Africa fail. I think he'd like to see South Africa flourish. And I think that he would want to position the United States as a partner in that growth and jobs agenda. But it doesn't mean we should go around poking sticks in the eyes of our partners. I think we should be looking for mature adult dialogue that focuses on how we can improve the relationship rather than worsen it.
It has emerged on social media again, as it does from time to time, a quote from Ambrosani's book where Cyril Ramaphosa allegedly told him that he's going to deal with the whites by boiling a pot, the frog boiling, and many people even call Ramaphosa the frog boiler president. Are you seeing, do you give any credence to that approach, that it's a slowly, we'll sort the whites in South Africa out over a lengthy period of time? Or are you seeing a true partnership here?
I would say it's a little bit of both, probably, Alec, if I may. The GNU is like the curate's egg. In some parts good, in some parts there's some problems and not that good. And the lack of consultation has really rankled with me. But I have addressed that directly to the president and said to him that this needs to be a proper partnership. One of the seminal questions I asked the president when we were still in the negotiation phase was, Mr. President, do you really want to do a deal with the DA? Do you really want to do it? And his answer was yes. And I've taken him at his word since then. I don't think there's some vast conspiracy against white South Africans. I think that the government has made some pretty silly decisions over the last two decades that have led to suffering for not only white South Africans. In fact, the people who bear the disproportionate burden of government's foolhardy policies and silly decisions are largely the black poor population. I think that the president sees that South Africans of all colors, but whites as well, have a role to play in economic growth and building the country. What you don't want to do is to have a mass exodus of people leaving your country, particularly people with skills, particularly people with capital, and particularly people who have something to offer in terms of economic growth. We shouldn't be exporting billionaires and entrepreneurs to other parts of the world. We should be keeping them here and harnessing their value and potential, unleashing. And so damage has been done with things like BEE and some of the more radical policies. But I do think that the GNU, and certainly my sense of where the president's at, is we have to work together if we're going to get this economy working again.
How are you going to address those issues like BEE, which are baked into the system now, stopping Starlink as an example, which would unleash enormous opportunity for all South Africans because it would be a fraction of the cost of what we're currently paying for bandwidth? How can you get a mindset shift in a party that sees, for instance, AfriForum as the architect of all the problems that are happening at the moment? If you have a look at the very strong statement sent out by the ANC, it's almost like AfriForum has smokkeld met die kop van Trump and Elon Musk.
Well, let me start by saying, I mean, they're not the problem. They do a lot of really great work, and they keep us on our toes as politicians, and they're a civil society body, and you know, we've got to accept that civil society has a role to play, and that role should be respected. Doesn't seem mean that we agree with everything they say and do, but certainly their right to exist and their right to do what they do and their advocacy is protected and should be as civil society organizations. We've got 5 years, Alec. We're not going to solve all of South Africa's ills in that five-year period. That is the reality. And if we're expecting to see the ANC stand on the steps of Parliament and say we're abandoning BEE in its entirety, I think you and I both know that would remain a pipe dream. But can we start to move the economy in a direction that starts to take away some of those more pernicious aspects? Absolutely. So we are in negotiations around Starlink at both the ministry level, but also at the national level, to try and get cheap internet access into rural areas. Excuse me, Alec, I'm still recovering from that dreadful cutting virus that kept me away from your show last week. We're still grappling then. I think there are ways we can do it.
So if we then just summarize and pull everything together, what I'm hearing from you is that what's happening at the moment between South Africa and the United States could be an opportunity. It could be an opportunity to reset that relationship as well. And who knows, perhaps find a new friend. Because when you have a look at this crazy Hague Group statement and the friends that South Africa's pulled together there, Cuba, Honduras, etc., no Russia, no China, no India, no Brazil in that latest stick in the eye for the Americans and their big ally, Israel. It seems as though there's a heck of a lot of work that needs to be done on repairing that relationship. But from what I hear, from what you're telling us here, that is not impossible.
Yeah, I think that we can reset it, but we need cool heads to prevail, Alex. We need the adults to sit in the room and work out that it's not in America's interest to have a bad relationship with South Africa. It's not in South Africa's interest to have a bad relationship with the US. We have to coexist in the global geopolitical environment. And so let's find ways in which we can cooperate. America has been a very good ally to South Africa over a long, long period of time. I think back to the work that the anti-apartheid movements were doing in Congress and the like then. They were on the right side of that particular argument. You look at the work that people like Robert Kennedy, Edward Kennedy, Jesse Jackson, Joe Biden, and many others did in highlighting the atrocities in South Africa and the injustices. America was there for South Africa during that time. I think it behoves us, if we want to see economic growth and jobs, that we are talking to essentially one of the largest economies in the world that provide a huge market for South African goods and offer many other strategic partnerships that goes beyond just simply aid. It also permeates into trade and investment. It permeates into cooperation on science and technology and a whole host of other environments. So I think we need to sit down maturely and decide what is in each of our best interests. And that cannot be a protracted war between us.
Worth adding there that the many people who understand economics would say that the real break in apartheid came in 1985 when one Willard C. Butcher, the chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, brought about South Africa's debt standstill, which turned the country into a net capital exporter. And of course, it could not continue with that. What are you not telling us, John? What's happening behind the scenes? I see Dean McPherson is now telling people or trying to tell people at the Mining Indaba to not get too het up over the EWC Act. But what is happening on your side that you're not saying to us as a nation that you can perhaps take us into your confidence on?
Well, let me just say there's a lot of behind the scenes work that goes into making these coalitions work. And obviously, there's a number of discussions that are ongoing, and obviously, you don't want to compromise those because you may have got it close to the try line, and you don't need to duff it up at the last, in the last 5 yards. I would, however, say this: that I think that part of the problem with the expropriation bill, or the act as it knows, is that it's been conflated by many people with the previous attempt by the ANC and EFF to amend Section 25 of the Constitution, the expropriation without compensation. And those issues, I think, have been heavily conflated. And so a lot of people are very panicked about it. The problem with the current act, as Dean McPherson and others have said very clearly, is not necessarily the compensation part. It's the mechanism that there's two mechanisms in there that deal with how expropriation should take place. And those are contradictory. And that's what Minister McPherson pointed out to the president before he signed it. And what we're going to have to try and fix in some way, either by going to court and getting a court declarator on the constitutionality or operability of that contradiction, or by launching a parliamentary amendment bill to get through to fix that. But every other democratic country in the world has an expropriation law. There's more powers in this particular bill than Donald Trump himself has under the eminent domain laws in the United States of America. It is a law of general application. It's a law that entrenches Section 25 of the Constitution rather than detracts from it. And yes, there are problems with it, but you know, the problems are not necessarily that this is now going to lead to massive land grabs by government or massive removal of farms and the like. That's not what this bill is intended for. It is intended to be able to provide government with the ability to, when big developments need to take place or there needs to be something that happens in the public interest, that it is able to obtain the land that it needs to run transmission lines, to build freeways and highways, to build housing, etc. I think that we must not conflate this particular act, which is not perfect. And I'm very clear. That's why we've committed to going to court, to either get the court order to fix it and to have it brought more in line with what we believe should happen. But this is not abolishing Section 25 of the Constitution. To do that, you would have to have required a constitutional amendment bill. We had one. It failed to pass in the Parliament. And this is an act that's actually now giving expression to Section 25 of the Constitution. Section 25 retains completely intact and remains the very best safeguard for South African citizens against arbitrary seizing of land and no compensation, therefore.
So your big role right now is to try and take heat out of this argument, I would surmise. Would you agree with that?
It's not so much to take heat, to explain to people that what the bill is, but also explain to them what it isn't. As I've just said, this is not an amendment of Section 25 of the Constitution. And bear in mind that Section 25 of the Constitution remains intact. And as you know, no law can ever subvert the Constitution. So all of those constitutional safeguards that citizens have in terms of the property clause in the Constitution remain completely intact. My job is to try and educate people about what is actually wrong with the bill, and we've attempted to do so. And that was not the subject of what we sucked out of the ether. It is the subject of senior counsel's opinion around where the problems with the bill exist. And they've pointed out to us very clearly the problems exist in the contradictory provisions, which are going to make the bill very, very hard to implement, to operate, given that it's now not clear which of the processes should be followed. So that's one of the reasons why we've committed to going to court as the Democratic Alliance to get that declarator. But we also could quite easily fix it through Parliament. And that was my frustration about the manner in which this was handled from the beginning, because had the president heeded the concerns of the minister, we could quite easily have fixed this in Parliament before he signed it into law. He could have referred it back. It could have then been fixed and then brought into line with the Constitution. But I think the minister's been very clear on his watch. No land grabs or expropriation without compensation for arbitrary political goals will happen on his watch. And I think he's given that assurance. And I think that's an assurance that South Africans should take heed of.
John, you've been very generous with your time and fighting that dreaded lurgy that we've been hearing from time to time, cutting virus. But just to close off with, the DA's role now in the fight between the ANC and President Trump, how can you make a positive contribution?
Well, but it's by calming things down and trying to be a responsible, mature interlocutor of the interests of both countries. As I said, it's not in America's interest to not have a good relationship with South Africa. We do have strategic minerals. We do have wonderful agricultural products that they benefit from. But likewise, we can't afford to have a bad relationship with the United States. We need to operate, as I said, in the global geopolitical environment. It doesn't mean that they agree with everything we do. It doesn't mean we agree with everything that they do. But I think it is in both of our interests as a country that there is mutual cooperation and at least channels for us to discuss these differences and how we can best resolve them. I don't think it's going to be assisted by saber-rattling from either side. It's going to need some mature cool heads to sit around a table and say, right, what do we require to have a good relationship going forward? And how is the quickest way for us to get there with the least disruption to our economy and with maximum benefit for both of our countries? I think that's the way to proceed.
But how do you do that when you've got such anger on both sides and such an ideological chasm?
I don't think that it's that as bad as it looks at the beginning. I mean, you know, I think that there's a lot of saber acting that happens in countries around the world. America's got its views on China, yet the two of them have to sit around a table to discuss matters because they are the two largest economies in the world. There's no reason, just because there may be some differences, that you can't sit down and say, right, these are the differences. How do we manage those? But here are the areas of commonality, and how can we build on these going forward? And I think everyone's got a role to play. I think the Western Cape government's got a role to play, and Premier Alan Windey. I think that national government ministers, I think we should be sending delegations to the United States to meet with key lawmakers and secretaries of state in Washington to explain to them what's going on, to take them through our medium-term development plan and to start to rekindle those relationships. Winston Churchill famously said, jaw-jaw is better than war-war. And in this instance, I think the more we can have jaw-jaw with our opposite numbers in Washington, I think the better it's going to be for the economy. I will certainly be reaching out to the new Secretary of Agriculture. I had a very good relationship with the previous one. We often would confer on Zoom and met each other on the sidelines of the G7 and G20 to take up the issues that, you know, from both of our sides where there were problems and how we could resolve them. And I certainly hope to have a good relationship with the incoming Secretary of State for Agriculture. And as I said, my office will be reaching out to him within the next week to try and set up bilaterals either on Zoom or in person so we can start to discuss how agricultural cooperation can continue between our two countries, because from the agricultural perspective, the access to their market is very important, access to technology and science, very important for our agricultural sector.
And at least the new or the likely new U.S. ambassador to South Africa is not an outsider. He knows all about how things work in this country. Is he from South Africa? Was he born here?
My understanding is he is a South African. He certainly spent a lot of time here. And of course, his mother-in-law was Rhoda Kadali. I mean, very well-known political commentator, writer, and academic in the country. And Joel wrote her biography. So I think he's very in tune with what is, where South Africa's come from, where it has stumbled, but now also where it needs to go. And I think it's in the where it needs to go phase where I think we should be reaching out and cooperating.
Well, that's Joel Pollack then. If he is appointed, he'll probably be by far the most insightful best prepared U.S. ambassador to South Africa. Just, John, it sounds to me like this is a crisis, but you're not going to let it be wasted.
Absolutely. I think, as you said, it's an opportunity for a reset, just as the crisis with the way in which the coalition partners are being treated has precipitated a reset in relations within the GNU. I think we now have an opportunity to grasp it. It is a new administration. We can't wish it away. It's going to be here for 5 years. We've got to be navigators. There's a famous saying, you can't be a sailor that curses the sea. We have to now navigate these choppy waters and find the best way forward, not for ideology, not for political ends, but for the national interest of South Africa.
John Steenhuisen is the leader of the Democratic Alliance, a member of the Government of National Unity, and the Minister of Agriculture. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.